Hi, this is Poe Johnson. I'm here once again with Within the Margins, and I'm speaking today to Dr. Mark Shapey, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Prairie View A&M. Do you prefer Mark or do you prefer Dr. Shapey?
You just call me Mark.
Okay, Mark. So can you just tell me a little bit about your research, your own background, and how you arrived at this research?
Sure. So I'm a philosopher by training, although I would say that I do more work that crosses over or intersects with advocacy now. So my professional position is I'm assistant professor of philosophy at Prairie View. I'm the only professor of philosophy at Prairie View, so I'm essentially the philosophy department. But I'm also on the board of directors for the AIDS Foundation Houston. And a lot of the research that I do actually has to do with HIV and AIDS. I began doing research on that when I was doing work on scientific methodology, and I was actually doing work on the discovery of scientific ideas, concepts, that kind of thing. And I had, for a long time, been very emotionally close, but also intellectually interested in HIV and AIDS, especially the early history, which was when I was a child that I remember very vividly, the early 80s and the paranoia that surrounded HIV and AIDS.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I became incredibly curious about what was going on scientifically, and I was curious about the process of guessing within science and medicine. So the index case of AIDS, the first case, or the first five cases which were diagnosed at UCLA Medical in 1981, became incredibly fascinating to me because there was so much guesswork that had to go on. This was something that the clinicians and the researchers had never seen before. So when I was doing that, I came across a lot of other information regarding various humanitarian organizations, you know, organizations that were helping people with HIV and AIDS. And I was finally a tenure-track professor, so I had some economic stability that I hadn't had before. And I felt as though probably out of my Catholic guilt from childhood that I should give back to the community. And so that's how I got involved in AIDS Foundation.
Okay.
So once I started volunteering for them, they gave me the title of expert liaison officer. So I do talks. For instance, I go to Baylor College of Medicine twice a year and talk to medical students there, for instance, about AIDS and discrimination, AIDS and risk groups. So a lot of the work I do has had to do with pigeonholing AIDS as a gay male disease and what the residual effects have been from that, and especially what the residual effects have been on both homosexual men and other communities wherein AIDS and HIV have been neglected. So, for instance, I've talked about the relationship between HIV and AIDS and the black community.
Absolutely.
And the negligence on the part of medicine in terms of addressing this community who's at the highest risk now for HIV, but also the stigmas that are attached to HIV from members of the black community, especially the black church.
Yes.
So that's some of the work that I've done. At the moment, I'm doing a lot of work on prison sexual violence. And so a large scale on prison sexual violence and the issue of sexually transmitted diseases or sexually transmitted infections such as HIV within the prisons. But on a more specific scale and on a more policy-based scale, I'm doing work on transgendered female prisoners and the issue of placement. So I've been following the Passion Star case very closely, which is going on in Houston right now, which is a case concerning a transgendered female who was placed in 2003 in the Texas male prison system and subsequently has had to deal with more abuse than one can possibly imagine. I mean, it's just really heinous. And the one of the major issues has to do with the fact that transgendered female prisoners are placed in male prison populations. So they're almost immediately raped. So you have this obviously very pressing human rights issue, but you also have a very pressing public health issue. And I would say that you have an issue of something much more insidious, which is an issue of toxic masculinity, which bleeds into the rest of society from the prison culture. So that's one of the major things that I'm doing work on as well. I also do work on African ethics mm-hmm. and on African ethics mm-hmm. and public health. And in fact, I'm writing a piece right now on using African ethics, specifically the South African concept of Ubuntu, to re-examine the idea of punishment within the United States, and specifically to address this idea of prison sexual violence, and to help argue against prison sexual violence as a form of just deserts. So I'm using Ubuntu as this argument against the idea that prison sexual violence is somehow okay, or that somehow people deserve this.
So let's unpack some of these terms that you just brought up, so for clarification.
Sure.
So there's first Ubuntu. What is Ubuntu?
Well, Ubuntu is it's a term that comes from the Bantu languages mm-hmm. within Africa. And it's usually translated as "I am because we are."
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to use the standard translation of that. Now, when you begin to unpack that term, and there's a lot of unpacking that goes on, so the things I'm saying are not just accepted within the study of African ethics. I want to make that clear, because there's a lot of debate within African philosophy about what Ubuntu means, about what it entails. But it's a very fascinating term, because it was this term that had crept up in discourse within the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
but not in a very interesting philosophical way, I guess we could say.
Okay.
And at the end of apartheid, it was very purposely used as a motivator, or as an underlying concept in rewriting the Constitution. So there was, this is in 1993, these discussions really took off. If I remember correctly, the first South African Constitution comes into being in 1996. Ubuntu is not mentioned in the final product, but it is mentioned in the discourse leading up to it. And Ubuntu becomes a term that's used quite a bit within legal discourse in South Africa.
Okay.
And one of the ways that it's used is in addressing punishment or the criminal justice system. So the guiding idea was the idea of reconciliation
mm-hmm.
rather than punishment for the sake of fear or punishment for the sake of retaliation.
Yeah.
This is a really intriguing concept to me, especially with regard to the idea of just deserts or prison violence. And within South Africa, the idea was the last thing that we want to do, meaning the last thing the South Africans wanted to do, was turn the new government, the post-apartheid government, into an apartheid government itself. Exactly, into a government of separation. So Ubuntu became this really fundamental concept. Now, within the 21st century, the term has been discussed at length by philosophers who are exploring exactly what is an ethic of Ubuntu, what does that mean, is it applicable, and right now there are debates going on about whether or not it really is an ethic.
Mm-hmm.
I argue that it is. This is based on a lot of people's work, but in part it's based on the work of Thaddeus Metz,
mm-hmm.
who argues for an ethic of Ubuntu. But there's recently been a paper saying that Ubuntu is this kind of meaningless ethical concept. You know, it shouldn't even really be discussed.
Interesting.
My argument, I'm supposed to go to South Africa in the fall and give a presentation at a conference on African philosophy, past, present, and future. And my argument is actually that Ubuntu is a concept that the West needs,
mm-hmm.
that we have entered an era of such hyper-individualism that...
So we need a reformation of the sort of the public...
Precisely, exactly. And so with Ubuntu, one of the guiding ideas is that community precedes personhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the individual becomes a person through the community. And so this is a real fundamental concept within Ubuntu that I think is sorely lacking here, especially when we get into conversations about community.
So it's interesting what you say then. This will be like the last question.
Okay.
is to think about this Ubuntu and then in concert with tragic masculinity, because one of the things that happens within prison culture, at least to my understanding, is that it's a kind of sort of there's a particular code, and you sort of see this in like street code too,
mm-hmm.
so like no snitching.
It's right,
like,
right.
There's a sort of collective understanding that whatever happens within these particular walls, that's where it stays,
mm-hmm.
right? So like, whatever we do, whatever we say, whatever happens is only sort of be sort of judged within these particular
mm-hmm.
terms. So there is a kind of Ubuntu there already if you look at it from that perspective. Or would you say that I'm completely wrong? I sort of look on your face and
skeptical. It's not that, I mean, this is something that actually comes up in the literature because the community is not merely a closed set.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guiding ideas in Ubuntu is the idea of inclusiveness. So, and this is very interesting. This is something that I've thought about, the whole snitches get stitches thing. Because this is something that the philosopher, he's not talking directly about Ubuntu, but he is talking about community. The philosopher Gayeki, who is an Akan philosopher, he's from Ghana,
mm-hmm.
He talks about is that the community within at least Akan philosophy, so I don't want to conflate Akan philosophy and South African philosophy, but there are similarities between them, that it does not exclude the individual who speaks against the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the community thrives and is the community in part because of the person or the persons who express their authenticity. So what you're bringing up with the whole snitches get stitches thing or speaking outside of the smaller community or the exclusive community, what that presupposes is some kind of negative quality to speaking against the community or speaking against the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, what it does is it undermines, I would say, and I think that Gayeki would say this as well, it actually undermines the ability of the community to flourish, that the community is not a static thing. This is, going back to the idea of prison culture, one of the greatest problems with prison culture, one of the greatest problems with police culture,
mm-hmm.
which I would say actually mirrors prison
Absolutely.
Culture, is that it is a static community. So the idea is that anyone who speaks out against it is trying to change it. You should not change it. The idea that I think is put forth in Ubuntu is one of fallibilism, is one in which the community is something that is always malleable, it's plastic, if you will, and that a community really can't exist that's not plastic. I mean, I'm going out on a limb in saying that.
Okay.
That might be a dangerous statement. I don't know. But I think that the community is something that is the community
constantly
because
changing.
It's constantly transforming. Yeah.
So that's interesting. It's like one last little final note. Like, so how do you sort of connect these things? So you're a philosopher and you're dealing with African philosophy in this one hand, and you're also dealing with sort of prison culture in America, and then it sort of goes into then from prison culture and HIV sort of studies before that, you then sort of connect that to the sort of violence being perpetrated against trans women
mm-hmm.
in particular who are in male prisons. Like, so how do you see this connection? Do you see this as a kind of natural evolution? Or is this, this might be too big of a question, or do you see this as kind of, they're all in some way servicing the same goal?
I think that, okay, so to address that very last part of your question, servicing the same goal, I would say on a very general level, they're all servicing social justice.
Mm.
That social justice is what the goal is,
okay.
right? To go back into your question, though, a little bit with regard to the connection between, I would say, African ethics and then I'm really a pragmatist.
Mm-hmm.
So African ethics offers a number of very, very useful tools that have been neglected by Western philosophy. And I would say that they've been degraded, ignored, devalued, all because they're not a part of Western philosophy. And so they've, you know, there's this ethno-philosophy that's gone on that says, oh, well, that's African philosophy. It's somehow separate. And we should look at that in this kind of historical way. And it might be interesting. Then what my move is to say, we have all of these problems, right? So we've got all of these problems with HIV and AIDS, with the prisons, with transgender persons, with issues of social justice. Why not use these really, really useful ethical tools that happen to be African, right? Okay. So it's not for the sake of novelty. It's not the idea. I would never say, oh, they're exotic ethical tools, right? It's actually, the fact is that they, I think, are much more useful than many of the Western ethical tools that are being used. It doesn't mean that sometimes they can't be used in tandem, because I think they can at moments. But I think that, look, we've tried to address a lot of these problems through the use of other philosophical tools. And maybe we've gotten someplace, maybe we haven't. But this, to me, seems to push us not necessarily into the solution, but closer to the solution.
Okay, I think that's great. I think that is exactly where we're going to sort of finish off for today. I want to thank again Dr. Mark Chapey for joining us today, and this is Poe Johnson for Within the Margins.
Thanks a lot.